Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a historian and advocate about the ongoing protests against police brutality and calls to send in the military to stop demonstrations. First, with the University of Wisconsin system facing unprecedented financial strain because of the COVID-19 pandemic, outgoing President Ray Cross has issued a plan calling for eliminating duplicate majors across UW campuses and centralizing administrative functions. But Rich Kramer reports that the proposal has been met with skepticism by faculty and some administrators who just went through a major restructuring process.
The blueprint for the UW system beyond COVID-19 calls for campuses other than UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee to specialize their missions and prioritize degree programs by January. After that, Cross's office would decide which ones to eliminate, a process he says would inevitably result in layoffs. It also recommends centralizing administrative services and creating a system-wide online education model. When faculty members heard about the major restructuring proposal, there was a sense of deja vu for some.
The process is what, for me, is strikingly similar.
That's Professor Mary Bowman of UW-Stevens Point. She says over the past 3 years, the campus has undergone two major restructuring efforts. The first, initiated by Cross in 2017, merged two-year colleges with four-year universities. Then, in 2018, Chancellor Bernie Patterson called for eliminating 13 degree programs, mostly in the humanities. Bowman says that sparked a two-year fight, but ultimately the majors were spared.
We've got these plans that were, largely drafted without input from faculty, staff, students. In this case, I understand it was without input even from the chancellors or provosts. So very much a top-down plan that was released in the press.
Though it was light on details, Cross's blueprint was jarring enough for UW-Eau Claire Chancellor Jim Schmidt to release a campus memo co-authored by shared governance groups saying the recommendations had the potential to significantly and negatively impact UW-Eau Claire. He declined to comment on the memo and Cross's proposal. But UW-Eau Claire student body vice president Anna Zabel helped edit the campus response.
It was kind of maybe gutsy. It's been rare that we've seen this many people sign off, as well as administration, on something that has really taken a stance like this.
Zabel says Cross's call for campuses to specialize their missions was especially concerning because UW-Eau Claire promotes a slogan Schmidt calls the power of and. In essence, it means students are encouraged to explore campus offerings and find their passion rather than focusing solely on a career path. In another rare moment of criticism from within the UW administration, Regent Bob Atwell said during a listening session with shared governance members that he wasn't thrilled with how it was announced.
I think that the process as it rolled out at the last Regents meeting was tremendously confusing to a lot of people, including Regents, I might add.
But despite disagreements over the plan and its rollout, the UW system faces an estimated $212 million in lost revenues through summer due to COVID-19. That's on top of a seven-year freeze on undergraduate tuition increases at four-year universities and a mandate from state lawmakers to spend down tuition cash balances to fill cuts in state support.
It's sad, but true, that many people want the benefits of world-class higher education without the necessity of paying for it.
That's Terry Hartle, Senior Vice President at the American Council on Education. He says most UW campuses face a perfect storm of reduced state funding, tuition limits, and declining enrollment. Hartle says Cross's proposal is a thoughtful one, though it may be hard to swallow.
Nobody is going to like this particular proposal because it sadly means less higher education. But I think the system has been placed in the unenviable position of having to have this discussion, whether people want to have it or not.
The blueprint plan is now in the hands of UW Regents, and how it's implemented will be up to the next UW system president. Meanwhile, faculty and staff resettling from the last restructuring process are waiting to see what public higher education in Wisconsin might look like in the wake of expected cuts caused by COVID-19. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, what did you do yesterday? How about a week ago today, a year ago? There's a good chance you don't remember. I don't. But what if you'd been taking notes each day, every day? You could learn an awful lot about yourself. There are people all over the world who track their every move. They're called self-trackers, and our next guest is one of them. He's been taking notes about his everyday activities for years. Now, just shy of his 10-year goal, what has he discovered about himself and what changes he might make to live a better life? Morris Villarreal is a professor of animal physiology at the Technical University of Madrid and author of Self-Trackers, 8 Personal Tales of Journeys in Life Logging. Morris, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, lovely to be with you.
What led you to set out on this project of tracking basically everything you did?
Well, it started about 10 years ago when shortly after my 40th birthday, and I was kind of looking back, you know, one of these birthdays that are important in your life, and looking back and saying, well, what happened in these 40 years and what's going to happen in the next 40 years? And then I started thinking, well, I should maybe track my time a bit better because I didn't have that much to show for the previous 40 years. I mean, I'd done a lot and had a family, children, et cetera, but I didn't really have that much data. And since I work in science, I thought I needed maybe a bit more quantification of what I was doing.
What is the method you decided to use to track your life?
Well, really, it started off, it is not a method per se, but I just started off saying, well, I'm going to get like a nice notebook and I'm going to start logging or writing down the things I do. Previously, I had written down maybe diaries, like, you know, kind of a summary of what I was doing during the day. And now I was thinking I could use a different method, similar to what I use to study animals, is I've studied animal behavior, is to write down like just a timeline of the day and different events and the duration of those events during the day. So it's kind of like a logbook. And just to continue, I started to do it and I said, well, maybe I can last a month or a year. And I just kept on doing it. Now it's been almost 10 years.
And how many notebooks is that in that time?
As we're speaking, I'm writing in a notebook, 310.
Wow. Okay. Now, you've observed animals with a similar method, and presumably we can learn a lot about animal behavior by checking in with them over time. Have you started to learn things about you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's been a lot of things I've been learning over the years. After about a year and a half of doing this, I ran into a group, or I heard about a group, and then I started collaborating with them. It's a movement called Quantified Self. So this was back in 2011, 2012. And then I started a blog, and then I started noticing, well, there are different things that I could track, or I could notice different things that made me happier or more upset or frustrated. So it's hard to summarize it all in one sentence, but there are a lot of different aspects of life that if you start getting more data about, you think about it more in detail, and then you can say, well, I'd like to improve this or forget about this or change this.
Can you talk about one improvement you've made based on taking these notes and going back over them?
Yeah, I think I can give you maybe a more simple one, which is I used to have more back problems, and then I started noticing if I was walking more, I'd have less or you know, getting up. And so I decided to walk to work instead of taking the car. It's about a 15-minute drive and walking. It takes me a bit in the metro, a bit walking outside. It takes me about 45 minutes. So that was a change, and it actually improved my life substantially because I was spending more time outdoors. I was walking, and I didn't have any more back pain. So that's like a health thing. And I think more in a psychological way, there's another aspect there that I think is interesting is what people call metacognition. So it's like thinking about thinking, no? So this kind of logging process helps you to think more about how you think and what things you're doing. So you can see how that varies some days. Some days are a bit more stressful, like maybe Monday or Tuesday. Some months are a bit more stressful. So you can kind of get a better hold on saying, well, should I make the decision now because I'm in a situation where maybe I won't be able to make the best decision? Maybe I should hold off and wait a couple hours or days. So I think you get to know yourself a bit better. You kind of get more feedback from yourself, you know, by looking at the notebooks from previous days or weeks.
What about negative stuff? Are there things you learned by doing this that you're like, Morris, why do you do that? Things you decided you might not have thought about, but you didn't like about yourself along the way?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, typical situations where maybe, as I was kind of mentioning, you're stressed and then you're saying, okay, well, I could do this. I know maybe this isn't the best thing I should do right now, but I'm going to continue defending this point in this discussion, or I'm going to continue doing something. And you can you notice things like, well, maybe I should back off a bit, or maybe I should consider the other person's opinion a bit more in this debate, because in the midterm to long term, you're going to have to get along with this person, whatever, in your department or in a couple or whatever. So you don't necessarily, you tend to avoid maybe a direct conflict and then see it in a longer kind of long-term basis. And I think in that sense, things have changed. Like maybe in the past, like if I go back 8 or 9 years, I had more, maybe, how do you say, specific points during the week where I could have probably backed off, but I didn't. And then now I could just see it more like a long-term process and say, okay, well, just you can relax on this. You don't have to make a decision right away or do this. So you can see it in a more long-term light.
We're talking to Morris Villarroel, professor of animal physiology at the Technical University of Madrid. He has been tracking his life with notebooks, as much detail as he can, for almost 10 years. Morris, I got to say, reading about your project, I thought, what if I did this for myself? And my fear would be that in writing it and going back and reading it later, it would be really boring and kind of tedious, which is maybe a lesson in and of itself. Did you find that for yourself at all?
No, I didn't. I think also there are some people who come to me and say, well, I think if I did this for myself, I wouldn't really necessarily feel that good. You know, it doesn't really make me feel that good to look back and see myself in a previous light. Actually, there are conferences and things you go to about this stuff. And I think there's kind of a range of people who look at their diaries from when they're 16 and they're like, oh, that poor guy, you know, if only I could have told him this or that. And then other people are like, oh, I'd really like to look at this diary when I was 16 and just see what I was up to and look at it more maybe in a positive light. So I think it depends a bit on your personality. Like I don't think this is necessarily for everybody to do like every day, but for me at least, looking back, I don't find it boring. And I find it every day. You think, oh, this is what I did on Monday, and then you look back and you say, well, wait a second, I also did this and this and 18 other things. So no wonder I was tired, you know, when I got home. So it helps you put things into context and maybe even control yourself a bit better. And then out of those events or just things that happens, that say, well, maybe next Monday I'll spend a bit more time doing this and less time looking at my phone or answering phone calls. Things that maybe interest me more or in the long term are going to maybe be, you know, motivate myself more, be better for me.
I understand at one point you tried augmenting this with something that took pictures of you at regular intervals. How did that help or hinder your efforts?
Yeah, that was they're called life logging cameras. This was a company called Narrative that made these cameras. So it's really small, like a couple inches square. And you just clip it on your shirt or your sweater, your jacket, whatever. And you can time it. So take pictures every 10 seconds or 30 seconds or a minute. And you just put it on. It doesn't really take pictures of me, but it takes pictures of what's directly ahead of me, kind of like a body cam that a police might wear, but it doesn't take video, just takes still pictures. So I did that. Actually, I did that for about 3.5 years. And so every day during those 3.5 years, I have pictures every 30 seconds. I thought it was going to maybe help me with my journaling or my logging, because there's a lot of stuff that I don't write down. I found out, you know, like you meet somebody in the hallway and chat for 5 minutes. Well, I don't necessarily write that in my logbook, or sometimes I forget. And then, but with the camera, you can see that. So it does pick out different kind of a granularity of what's happening during the day. And it does underline, I think, all those, again, I was saying before, all those actions, all those things that are happening in your life, and that your brain works hard to kind of forget about. So that could be looking at it. Some things maybe are worth remembering, some things aren't. But I don't know, simple things like in your work and you meet somebody in the hallway. I think depending on how they treat you or what they're saying to you or how that very short event worked out, it does affect, in a way, the rest of your day or maybe your next event, because, you know, if it was a pleasant, nice, reaction, it affects you a little bit. If it was somebody you were trying to avoid or whatever, it does have some negative effects. So it does kind of put things into context later when you say, well, I had a bad day or a good day. These things add up, you know.
Morris, as we wrap up, do you plan to keep doing this well into the future?
I think so. I was planning back in 2010, I was thinking, well, I could do this maybe a maximum 10 years. I've met other people who are doing things for even longer. So there's kind of a community there, and we kind of support each other. And I think so. I think I'm going to be 50 in February, and I plan to continue doing it because it seems to be, well, it's helpful for me. Something I like to do. And the family and the friends don't complain too much about it. So I think I'll continue for now.
Morris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Morris Villarroel is professor of animal physiology at the Technical University of Madrid and author of the book Self-Trackers, 8 Personal Tales of Journeys in Life Logging. We talked to him about his quest to record and document every moment of his life over the past 10 years. Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about protests, police, with an Eau Claire perspective on the ongoing protest situation. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum asking the question, what was Milwaukee's first hip-hop song?
Our friends at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee put out a podcast last year called Backspin, the search for Milwaukee's first hip-hop song.
Are you ready?
Hosts Tyrone Miller.
I'm just really curious about just hip-hop in general. Love the culture, been a part of it my whole life.
And Justin Barney.
My interest in this is academic. I want to know what the first hip-hop song is. That I want to answer that question.
They take listeners on a musical and historical journey as they talk with pioneering Milwaukee DJs and reminisce about dance clubs and house parties of the past. While listening to Backspin, you quickly learn that what is Milwaukee's first hip-hop song is a really complicated question. Milwaukee's first hip-hop record could be this song, Class A. It was released in 1981 by the Majestics.
We are down, and for real, we all have a lot of sex appeal. So hey, by the way, the women said we are Class A.
The Majestics were a funk and R&B group that put out a disco rap song.
Do y'all consider yourselves rappers, or did y'all just make a rap song?
We just made a rap song.
Gotcha.
But we ain't no five, we rappers. When dream of it. Because you don't call anybody can rap.
Yeah.
Because you rapping now to put the music behind.
Right.
See?
After Class A came out, it didn't have a huge impact. It didn't inspire a new wave of rappers. But then this song came along in
1985.
We were definitely the first, like, official hip-hop crew to release a record of hip-hop in Milwaukee, and that was the song called Attack on the Wax.
That's Todd Thomas, a.k.a. Peachy, a.k.a. Speech.
Excuse me, Peachy. May I?
May you what?
May I get on the turntables?
Why, of course.
And we felt it was cool, but we felt, at least me, I felt we could do better. So we went back in the studio and did a better version of that song and included 3 other songs on that EP, I should say.
PG on the steel, and you know he's chill. 2 techniques under his hand, cause that's the real deal. Fresh beats are delivered to the north and south and at
any given Jimmy keeps fuck of the house.
Yeah, that was the first hip-hop record that I remember, though, from a hip-hop crew.
Miller and Barney found the majority of the music community credits Speech with jumpstarting the city's hip-hop scene.
Every single person that we've talked to, from the MCs, the DJs, producers, every single person mentioned Speech. Is that correct?
Literally every single one.
And it was not just, okay, I rapped with him. He produced a song for him. He influenced them by just being such a great guy in the community. Or they knew him, they worked with him, they met with him. They just knew where he lived. He was just around.
And everyone had such reverence,
right,
for Speech.
One of the things that I think people wouldn't realize is that we never traveled to New York. We didn't know anybody that ever written or did a rap record. So for us, it was a lot of guessing. And unlike today, there was no internet. You couldn't go to YouTube and check out how somebody did something. And we were trying to do the best we could to make an authentic hip hop record. You know, like, I didn't want to be just a quote unquote Milwaukee artist. You know what I mean? Like, I knew that Milwaukee had to rise to the occasion of New York because New York was defining hip hop. And, you know, I wanted Milwaukee to have that same legitimate sound. And I feel like we accomplished it with that EP.
Soon after, Speech left Milwaukee to go to school in Atlanta, where he formed the Grammy Award-winning group Arrested Development. The rest is music history. Check out Radio Milwaukee's podcast Backspin and decide for yourself. Was the city's first hip-hop song Class A or Attack on the Wax? Does it even matter what came first? Take a deeper dive into this story through the podcast Backspin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up today after the news, we'll talk about protests and what it means when people call for the military to be deployed to demonstrations. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while indoor movie theaters remain closed or very limited, drive-in theaters may be having a big moment. From pop-ups to those that have been around for decades, we'll talk about their place in entertainment history. First, it's been over a week since protests started in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and around the country to demonstrate against the killing of George Floyd and other unarmed people of color by police. A number of those protests began peacefully, and many remained that way. There were also incidents of looting and attacks on protesters by police departments. As more of these protests followed the pattern, President Trump had this to say earlier this week.
I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets. Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
Our next guest joins us now to talk about the protests and the prospect of military intervention. Salika Duxworth-Lawton is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. She's also vice president of the group Uniting Bridges. Salika, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Before we dig into some particular issues, just as someone who studies, among other things, social movements and African-American history, I wanted to get your big picture thoughts on what we've seen over the last week.
Well, we've seen two things, and I think that people have to separate the two overlapping things. We have seen a nonviolent uprising against police brutality on the part of the protesters that is multiracial and multisexuality. But we have also seen a regulation, which is a kind of attack by white supremacist accelerants and infiltrators on Black, brown, and queer businesses. We've seen this weaponization of social media where white supremacists have tried to get white people to be angry and have them attack multicultural people. And I'm happy to say that in most cases that has not happened. It's almost like we saw white supremacist Tet, like 1968, where they rose up because they thought all white people agreed with them and nobody came. So it's interesting on two parts. And I think that the attack on the journalists, which is unprecedented, has forced journalists to move out of their narrative frame, which is always to conflate the looters with the protesters, and to begin to actually see the separation and to recognize the brutality that the community has always seen.
You have floated the idea on social media of kind of a protest marshal to help really make the difference between the protesters and the looters very clear, among other things. Can you talk about that concept and how you hope at least it might work?
Well, what we want are people who are trained in nonviolence, and they're also trained in de-escalation, and for them to stand between the counter-protesters and the protesters. These are people who aren't going to react, and by their discipline, they will make it very clear who is misbehaving. Very much like what we saw in the 1960s, although we're probably going to call them ushers and not marshals, because what we want them to do to be escorts, we want them to model the discipline of nonviolence, and we want to open up the space for our younger people. It's a lot to ask our younger people to have to stand there and be called the N-word and be called all these insults and et cetera. So the ushers are going to be the ones, and especially the white ushers, to face the counter protesters and to say, no, we don't agree with you. And the idea of a line of multicultural, multi-race, multi-sexuality ushers undermines the white supremacist argument that all white people hate people of color. And that's not true. It's not true at all. So we want to undermine that argument by showing the people who want to protect the community, if that makes sense.
A lot of the media attention has focused on what's going on in bigger cities around the country. Can you give us a firsthand view of what's been happening over the last week in the Eau Claire area?
Well, we are 90 miles from Minneapolis, as you can imagine. We have had a lot of social media tomfoolery is what I would put it. Hacking people's Facebooks to put fake posts on, masquerading as if they were an official organization. So there was a post claiming to be from an Eau Claire area response team, and there is no such organization. So a lot of it has been rumor mongering and trying to provoke misbehavior. We in Eau Claire have organized to send supplies up to Minneapolis to the places that have been burned. And I'd say shout out to Serena Wagner, Jack, to Jake Lindell and Jalen Cart and Jalen. Oh, I just lost her last name because they've been the main ones, or Jalen Carson. They've been the main ones organizing this. So a lot of what we've been doing, there's a lot of ties between Eau Claire and Minneapolis. We've been seeing the raw footage. We've been talking to people and checking up on people. And there are some people, Jake Lindgren is who I was thinking of. And you can contact them if you're in the Eau Claire area, or take supplies to the Lismore, by the way, starting tonight at 6 o'clock. We've been trying to support people in Minneapolis who have been hurt by what has happened. And we have been hurt. Many of the people who live in Eau Claire work in Minneapolis. They come back and forth. And of course, we've been rocked because they have. Last week, there was an incident where three young white boys were caught by AIM in Minneapolis looting a liquor store. At first, it was reported they were from Eau Claire. They said they were from Eau Claire. Now there are reports that they're actually from St. Croix or from Hammond. But it really forced Eau Claire to take a look at ourselves and where we sit. And I think that the city has risen to do good. The majority of people here, no matter what their race are, is good.
We're talking to Salika Duxworth-Lawton, professor of history at UW-Eau Claire, getting her perspective on the protests of the last week. Now, we heard President Trump there floating that idea of sending active duty military forces into cities to maintain order. He says, as a activist yourself, but also a historian who focuses on things like military history, what are your thoughts on that idea?
Well, the first is that the Army doesn't want to do it. they have seen that duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to be honest, they really would prefer not to do it here. And given that surge strategy is to work with the community to protect itself, I'm not exactly sure what he thinks he's going to accomplish. But the second thought I have is that the Insurrection Act has never been tested at the Supreme Court level for a president ordering in troops on his own authority. Troops have always been brought in at the governor's request. So this will set up a Supreme Court fight that will, by the time the fight is dealt with, the entire crisis may be over.
And I understand you coordinate a Juneteenth celebration every year. That would just, I think, be 2 weeks from today. How will this one feel amidst everything that's going on?
Juneteenth this year will be virtual, and the younger people, high school and college students, are working with me to coordinate it. And I think it will be a time for our community to come together and to decide that for us, what will equality look like? Freedom for people of my race, I am Black, looks like equal treatment and equality. Freedom, evidently, for some people is getting a haircut. I think we need to have a strong community response and discussion about what freedom looks like and how we can make liberty and justice for all real. And what does that look like in real life?
Salika, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Salika Duxworth-Lawton, professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. She's also vice president of the group Uniting Bridges. She joined us today to talk about ongoing protests against police violence in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up, no need to squeeze past rows of seated people at an outdoor drive-in theater. That's something that's making them maybe well-suited for this particular moment. We'll talk about the drive-in theater experience and ask you to share yours. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to WPR's education reporter about Wisconsin schools and how they're trying to plan their budgets without knowing exactly how fallout from the coronavirus pandemic could affect them financially over the next several school years. Now, in addition to the handful of drive-in theaters still operating around the state, many parts of Wisconsin are getting pop-up drive-in theaters as well, setting up in areas like sports fields and parking lots. While there's still a lot of uncertainty about traditional theaters reopening, drive-ins have embraced their potential role as the entertainment of the summer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories of going to a drive-in theater? What was it like? Do you still go to the few that have stuck around over the years? Have you been to one of these pop-up drive-in movies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an assistant professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, Jocelyn, I think in recent film history, drive-in theaters are kind of an afterthought lately. Do you see them maybe getting more popular now with people not quite ready to crowd into a theater?
I definitely do. And it's really funny. Drive-ins actually have a long history of being positioned as the healthier alternative to the traditional movie theater, especially during something like a polio outbreak in California in the 50s when children were quarantined from the theater. Drive-in owners took the opportunity to advertise their theaters as the healthy place to go where you would not get sick.
Interesting. And yeah, I know theaters have been concerned for health going back to at least the so-called Spanish flu over a century ago. But I got to say, most of my life and my movie-going experience, I haven't stopped and thought at all about the health risks of being at a theater. It takes some kind of special outbreak like this to put that first and foremost in our mind, it seems like.
It really does, and maybe that's a good thing. But at the same time, I think it also enables us to consider these questions about how the theater has always sort of functioned as a place where there's conversations going on around health and around what it means to be a healthy American citizen.
Well, I want to give a listen to something taking us back in time just a little.
It's refreshment time, folks.
Taste that beats the others cold. Pepsi pours it on.
That's a commercial encouraging drive-in attendees to grab some Pepsi during the intermission. Take us back in time. What would it be like to visit a drive-in movie? I'm just old enough to have done this some as a kid, but to visit, for those who haven't, take us back to the drive-in movie at the height of popularity.
The height of popularity would be about 1956. That's when we
not see...
that is when they are the most popular. that's when we've got about 4,000 theaters, drive-in theaters around the country, which is a pretty staggering number. So you would load up your car with as many people as possible because drive-ins are a great way to experience movies for a really cheap ticket price. You'd pull up to the drive-in, pay your admission fee, find a spot. Tune your dial to the FM station with the brand new speakers in your car. That's a real possibility in the mid-1950s when it wasn't before. You'd watch the movie, probably not pay that much attention to it. If you're a teenager, you're probably making out in the back seat with your girlfriend. head over to the playground if you're a family and let your kids run around on the swing set while you're watching whatever B-horror or sci-fi movie is showing up there. And definitely hit the concession stand for a lot of snacks.
Now, I remember the one double feature I remember at a drive-thru as a kid was Smokey and the Bandit, and I was wide awake for that. And then The Sting, and I think that was more for the grown-ups. I feel like I fell asleep in back of the station wagon, I'm going to say. Is there something about the kinds of movies that people made with drive-in theaters in mind?
Absolutely. Especially in the 1950s, which again is the real height of popularity for the theater. The drive-in is thought of as a kind of like unsavory place by a lot of the main Hollywood producers. They didn't want to send their big ticket items to the drive-in theater at that point in time for a lot of reasons that I'd actually love to talk about. So instead, you get a lot of cheaper films that fill the drive-in market. American International Pictures in particular was making a glut of cheap horror, sci-fi, and thriller movies that they could just throw up on screen at the drive-in, since we know that what's going on at the drive-in is not necessarily paying attention to the movie.
And you said for a lot of reasons that you want to talk about for the changing movies at the time. Go for it.
Yeah, I'd love to. I think we have this idea now that the drive-in is this place of kind of novelty and silliness. It's full of nostalgia. But at the time, it was thought of as not as genteel as the urban movie theater that you might go to on a fancier night out. And that's certainly because they were, you know, in more rural locations, you needed a lot of space for a drive-in. But one of the most interesting things about the drive-in in the mid-1950s is that many movie theaters across the country at that time were segregated spaces, especially in the Jim Crow South. But drive-ins tended not to be. So even in the South, it's the one space, the one theatrical space that's non-segregated. So you have all manner of American citizens coming to the drive-in in the mid-50s, black, white, working class, people of all different abilities, families, teenagers carousing, And it's just this kind of amazing combination of all sorts of people in one place at once. A lot of the time, again, not paying attention. So that then I think leads to an assumption that it's not as sophisticated and genteel a space, but it's really a space of Americanness.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is with us from UW-Milwaukee looking at drive-in theaters, the past, present, and maybe future, as they might look like an attractive alternative as theaters, you know, those indoor ones are maybe a little slower to open as we hopefully soon emerge from a pandemic. Jocelyn, I know a big question is, you know, as things start to get back to something like normal, are we going to be so hungry to get out of the house to do anything that, yeah, we'll do drive-in theaters, we'll do the indoor and sit five spaces apart or whatever? Or are we building this habit of watching at home and we've maybe added a streaming service and forget about it? We don't need to leave the house to see movies anymore. What are you watching for as we collectively make that decision?
Right. It's a really great question. I know that the Marcus Theaters are sponsoring some kind of thrown together drive-ins in the area right now, and they've actually been quite popular. But they're showing older movies, right? They're showing movies like Jaws. They're celebrating that kind of nostalgia for what film going once was. And I think that's really telling because it's going to be really hard for movie theaters to bounce back from the pandemic. It's going to be extremely difficult because they were already at a major disadvantage because of all the streaming technologies and so on that you point to. I kind of have an expectation that we really might see a continued resurgence of the drive-in, but that it will be in this kind of niche market that will be more about nostalgia, you know, and this kind of lost practice of movie going and how that might be a bit of a fetish for seeing movies again.
Are we losing something, do you think, by watching at home in our living rooms when for most of their history, movies were this collective experience? I'm watching it with, you know, these people at this time in this theater or in this parking lot.
Absolutely. I am somebody who really, really believes in the value of being together in public. And when we go to a movie theater or to a drive-in, any kind of public viewing experience, we're with a bunch of people that we didn't really choose to be with. They could be any number of members of any kinds of cross-sections of society that we might not necessarily encounter normally in our everyday lives. And then we're sitting together and experiencing the same thing together. I think that is incredibly valuable. I think that can often be a kind of democratic activity. And I really hope that we are able to return to that because it is a way for people to come together and experience something at the same time.
So, Jocelyn, are you planning to track down some either pop-up or ongoing drive-in theaters to watch movies this summer?
I think I might try one this summer. Like everybody, I'm pretty afraid of the pandemic, but it does seem like a nice way to be able to get out a little bit and experience something with a bunch of other people at the same time.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an assistant professor of English and film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. She joined us today to talk about drive-in theaters, their heyday, and why they may make a comeback as movie theaters, indoor ones, are slower to reopen amid the pandemic. Well, what about you? Are you a fan of the drive-in, or were you when they were more readily accessible? What were some of your favorite memories, the things you liked about it, maybe the things you didn't like about it so much? And have you checked out some of the pop-up drive-in theaters that people have been starting to offer over the last really month and a half or so? Tell us about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can share your experiences, as always, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your drive-in movie story. Yesterday, here on Central Time, we talked about great do-it-yourself projects around the home and yard. A lot of you joined in with your projects on the phone, and we heard from some of our colleagues as well. And we've got some more to share with you now. First, from the Ideas Network Facebook page, Lindsay wrote and said, "We've enlarged our garden and finally begun to build our chicken coop." I hope the chickens haven't just been sitting around waiting for it. Build the coop first, then get the chickens, I think is the rule, though I don't have any experience with that. Thanks, Lindsay. Kate says, loads of gardening. Not sure if that counts as home improvement. Yes. Kate says, anyway, I loved today's show on Central Time with advice for successful home projects. Gardening definitely counts. Now, we had more stories from our colleagues here. Jennifer from Wisconsin Public Media says her list included cleaning and redoing the patio, and then they installed a hammock chair. And she says, now that we're spending so much more time out there, I'm figuring out how to screen it in. Then Allison Tyler from Member Services says, I love gardening, and we're currently working on adding some growing spaces to our yard of the house we bought about a year ago. And to kill two birds with one stone, they decided to use the junk that the previous owners had left to create their veggie lot. And I like this story. Judith Marie Heise shared a cleaning project, sorting Lego blocks for 4 hours. She says, sorting was so soothing. It's great to have a one-stop spot for them. Plus, my middle schooler is into playing with them again since there's every shape, kind, color to build with. You can keep sharing your do-it-yourself projects on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.